Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining me this week again. I have DC Pearson this week. When I say this week, I mean this episode is going up this week. This was recorded weeks ago, so my apologies to DC Pearson, but obviously follow him on Twitter, all that good stuff. And please be sure to get a copy of his book, Crap Kingdom, which you can get everywhere. And he wanted to talk about Bare Naked Ladies Gordon, which is cool because, again, we don't often have people who have these sort of non-traditional album choices that are, you know, just pretty much straight-up music. Obviously, this is humorous music, and we delve into that for the whole thing. This episode's a little poppy. This was recorded back when we were having some audio troubles, so my apologies, but it's not as bad as, you know, some of the worst poppy episodes that we've had. In general, it's just fine. So, yeah, enjoy the episode. All right. Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us this week. I have DC Pearson on the show.
Hey, guys.
We are going to talk about Bare Naked Ladies Gordon.
That's right.
And
seminal.
Right. 1992. Shit. All right. This is back when they were still the same band, which haven't they recently technically broken up?
21 years. I think the Bare Naked Ladies are still a going concern, but I think that I want to say his name is Stephen Page is no longer.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Which is sad. It's kind of a signature sound.
Yeah, I was going to say, is he like the sort of the lead singer?
Yeah, the guy who doesn't rap.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the guy who raps sometimes sings.
Right.
But this is horrible. I feel like I just totally uneducated my, but so I'm just going to depend on you. But I
felt bad. I didn't do a whole lot of pre-show Bare Naked Ladies reading. I was more going off of my general cultural impressions of the Bare Naked Ladies than any actual facts.
Mm-hmm.
Because something that I guess is interesting, well, I guess insofar as any of this will hopefully be interesting, something that may be interesting in a world in which any of, you know, you enjoy any of this.
Sure.
Is that I was really super duper into this album, but that I didn't really keep up with the Bare Naked Ladies after this. I didn't even get that that album when they had the one big
right
hit.
Which is the one where I would have heard of them first. You're a bit younger than I am, not by a whole lot, but enough why this album? Where did you get it? You're growing up in Phoenix.
Phoenix. I probably had it when it came out or a little bit after it came out through my dad.
Okay.
So my dad must have heard it. I would have to imagine maybe on like NPR or something like that. Because this is pre the internet. You wouldn't have found out about something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's not like there was like Nightline, Bare Naked Ladies album released in US to middling acclaim.
Yeah.
So I think he got this album. He played it and liked it. And then I was thinking about it today, and I was trying to figure out exactly what my entry point was to really liking it, because he had it, and then it became one of those things where I really wanted to you sort of make it your own, if that mm-hmm. makes any sense. You take something of your parents, and then you listen to it or read it or watch it enough 100%. That it sort of becomes yours,
yes.
Because they're a grown-up and they have a grown-up's amount of time in which to like things, which is to say not very much,
but
you're a kid and you have infinite time to just sit
that's
and listen
totally
to a
true. That's
CD
a really good
over
point.
And over again.
Oh.
And so I got really into it, and as I was listening to it today, I think my entry point, if I had to guess, would have probably been the new kid on the block song, and I can't remember exactly what it's called. I think it might be called New Kid on the Block.
That is what it's called, yeah. New Kid on the Block.
Written from the perspective of a non-identified member of the New Kids on the Block.
Right.
And I was a fan of the New Kids on the Block,
mm-hmm.
maybe, like, when they came out, I would say, like, 89 or 90.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I'm hearing this, I'm, like, a little bit over
of course.
New Kids on the Block.
Right,
and
right.
I get to feel like, oh, cool,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, distancing myself from who I was when I was, you know, six.
Yeah.
Like, I'm eight now. This is real shit. This is real shit we're talking about.
You were desperate to be a grown
mm-hmm.
child.
Sure.
That's
I think as all children are, right?
Sure. I think so. I think I can relate to that. I think Carlin and probably the Smothers Brothers are two where I had a similar experience wanting to sort of absorb them more than anybody else, as far as I knew.
You mean like you liked them more because they were seemed grown up to you?
Yeah, I think so, which is odd looking back. Maybe Class Clowns uh-huh. still is. Maybe Class right. Clowns still is. Smothers Brothers, not so much.
Yeah.
That's more of a grandmother thing, but I still love them to death. I love them.
Sure, sure, sure. Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting, as I was listening back to this, like, you There's so many references in it that were the first times that I was exposed to the things that it's referencing, like Stairway to Heaven, which he mentions. He's going to have to leave prom before they play Stairway to Heaven because he has to go study for a test, which is a bummer. And in general, with cultural references like that, I feel like, by the way, I asked to use your headphones and now I'm deciding I don't want to use them anymore, so I'm going to take them off. Or maybe I do want them. I can't decide. Well, you're gonna want to leave all this in.
That's it.
Going back to
it. Oh, God. Okay.
Not the headphones, even less. Great. So that was exciting for everyone listening. I don't know if it was this album or like Animaniacs or The Simpsons or something like that, but I had a real desire as a kid to want to experience culture like backwards, or I guess I didn't have a choice to experience culture backwards, because a lot of the things that I liked were full of pop culture references to things that I hadn't seen yet as I was a kid.
Of course.
Like, I remember having a professor in college and telling him, like, yeah, I think that my generation kind of experienced a lot of pop culture backwards through The Simpsons, and him being like, yeah, of course you would. That makes... Whoa, yeah, you did. Holy shit.
Yeah.
And it being kind of a revelation, because...
And he quit his job, though.
And then, he jumped out the window.
Okay.
to his death. He was like, well, there's nothing more to do here. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes brilliant sense. This is wonderful. I you kind of blew my mind, and I am also going to jump out the window in a second.
Oh, no, no.
It's good, but was there anything about... What was striking you about it other than it's fun music first, or were you really listening hard?
You mean as a kid or right now, as a kid, re-listening? I think that it was just that it was silly and irreverent, but that it wasn't explicitly like a joke, if that makes any sense. Like, it was funny music as opposed to comedy music. Even though going back and listening to it now, and I think I knew this a little bit at the time, but I would just skip the tracks as they came up, a lot of it's really serious. It's not I sort of almost had it filed away in my head as a, like, more a comedy album than a rock album that happens to have some songs that are funny.
Yeah, I can see
that. Because it has, like, you know, even just in the production, a lot of, like, pings and pows and zings and almost, like, comedy sound effects at certain points, not throughout.
Sure.
But, so I think I liked it on that level just because it had songs that were funny, but it wasn't explicitly just, like, joke songs or parody songs or whatever. So maybe it felt a little bit more grown up for that reason.
Yeah.
But then you would come across songs where you were like, okay, this is just like a slow song or a sad song or a song for girls or whatever. And then you would just want to skip that and get to the ones that are like, and they talk about Wrath of Khan and shit.
Yeah, I mean, for me, being exposed to latter-day Bare Naked Ladies, I was not expecting exactly what you're talking about, like that kind of production. Like the sound effects and all that. So I'm like, I can see why people dismiss them if they're not listening long enough.
Sure.
But I do think they're wonderful writers. I mean, everything I've ever heard them write is really great, and obviously comes from a place where they've dealt with a lot of women.
Yeah, you know? That's an interesting element to it too, because if you look at the cover, which I had no choice but to obsess over, because I would just come home after school and just sit and, like, it was probably in the beginning of, like, my latchkey kid phase, where I was no longer going to, like, after school daycare programs or anything like that. I just got to go home with my own key and let myself into my house, and then instead of doing drugs or smoking, would just listen to Bare Naked Ladies Gordon on repeat on the stereo system in the living room, which I don't even know if people have anymore. I forgot where I was going with that. Oh, yeah, but so you would look at the cover, and the guys on the cover, and if you get a chance to go and look at the actual, like, album cover that was, the CD and whatever, because I bought it on iTunes to re-listen to it, and it's, like, a different... More like,
or does it have the
slightly more like 1996 cover instead of 1992?
One,
yeah, this
is
exactly.
The one that you had,
yeah, okay. The top one. Okay. And those, they just look like fucking dorks, like they just look like super dorks.
The golf hat,
is yeah, there. Right?
Holy shit.
But there's something about it at the time as a kid whose favorite Ghostbuster was Egon, where you're like, how cool are these guys,
right?
With their, you know, the floppy golf hat, as you said, and the one guy has kind of a little bit of a high top fadeaway. One guy has white guy dreads.
Oh, yeah.
A couple guys just have giant glasses, and you're just like, oh, these guys are fucking cool.
Of course.
But yeah, as far that's something that struck me this time listening to it, is like, oh, a lot of the songs aren't even about like, oh, I wish you were my girlfriend or whatever, which is a lot of songs that nerdy guys write sometimes, especially in the genres of like emo or pop punk or whatever.
Sure.
It's songs about like having been in a relationship and it not having gone well, about having like screwed it up because maybe you have like rage issues. There's a lot of songs about, yeah, about just like being in a relationship that's not functioning, which is interesting when you are a kid and pretty much the only love songs you've ever heard is like, she loves you, yeah,
of course.
You know what
I
mean?
Yeah.
And so that's, of course, why, among other reasons, why you would skip them, because it's like, oh, they're slow and they're for girls. But, yeah.
You know he's not the kind of man who likes to see the world around him crumble to a ball around his feet. But he's always ready, he's always set, he's always well prepared. He's the most peculiar man you can ever meet. You know he's not the king of dead side men. And he's not the Tom Jones who lives next door. He's not the king of dead side men. And he hardly even lives there anymore. Excuse me, I hope you don't mind, but I followed you into this shop and I couldn't help but notice my crying crowd sticking out of your haversack. Well, I wouldn't mind riding you back. Subtle on the dance floor and he's suave around the bar. He's a quick draw with a lighter, he's a movie star. You know, he was quite a singer, quite an actor quite some time ago. He quite a famous broken lead that tends on TV shows. No, he's not the king of bedside manner.
Were you listening to this at a point where you were creatively coming of age or starting to be creative? Had you already been a creative
kid? I guess the sort of like this maybe this will answer the question, maybe it won't. The story that for me that typifies this album for my experience of it was I guess I probably would have been. Because I can't imagine I was listening to it like right when it came out. It was probably a year or two afterwards, so I was probably like 9 or 10. And I remember coming home from school, and I was maybe in like fourth or fifth grade, and I had a class project assigned where you were supposed to like give a monologue or something from the point of view of an assigned historical figure.
Okay.
And I think mine was FDR. And it was getting to the point where it was coming down to the wire as far as this like class project.
Yeah.
It was like it had been assigned like a month before, and then it was like due like in a day or two.
Sure.
And so I had a day where all I was supposed to do was like come home and just work on that project as per my mom, right? And so I came home, I had every intention of working on the project. But instead I was like, okay, well, let me just start out listening to Gordon by Bare Naked Ladies, as I did so many days after school. Also, I don't think I was allowed to watch TV, so that's an important to note why I may have just ended up listening to Gordon over and over again. And it was around either right before or after Easter time, and so we had like some little stuffed rabbit as a part of an Easter display. And I remember just laying on the ground and just kind of listening to Gordon and just fucking making that little stuffed rabbit kind of like dance along with it and like sing along with it because I knew it really well by this point.
Right.
And it's one of those things where it just starts out, it's like, oh, this is really fun. And then by the time you're almost done with it, you're like, this is genius.
Yeah.
This rabbit singing along with the album Gordon by Bare Naked Ladies will change the world.
Right.
If given the chance. Mm-hmm. Once people, first my parents, and then, you know, the mayor, and then the president, and then, you know, the heads of the major networks get a load of this rabbit dancing and singing along with the album Gordon by the Bare Naked Ladies, well, they'll probably just give me an honorary diploma to a university of my choice, and I won't even have to complete elementary school. It'll be the biggest show business phenomena in the world.
Right.
And elsewhere. Really convincing myself of that. And so I spent the entire afternoon just doing that. And just like, can't wait till my parents see this. This is going to be great. They're going to be like, this is hilarious and awesome. And completely forgot about and conflated my homework, which was to do this FDR project,
right,
with the making the rabbit dance and sing to the album Gordon by the Bare Naked Ladies. And so my mom came home and she's like, hey, how did your project go? And it's kind of like, and immediately in that moment, it's like, do I attempt to articulate the genius that is this rabbit dancing and singing to the album Gordon by Bare Naked Ladies, or do I just be like, I'm really getting into it. You know, I was just about to crack this FDR project. I haven't quite yet, but I will. And then, so I was in trouble. And it's interesting now, because I'm like, and I am an inveterate, maybe, I think that's how you use that word, procrastinator, and still am, and like, even now in my life, there are like certain things, certain super huge important things that I am procrastinating, and sure. It was funny again today to be about to come here and be like, well, I could do that stuff, but I also said I would do this podcast and listen to Gordon by Bare Naked Ladies, so it's still helping me procrastinate to this day, I guess is what I'm trying to say. No, but there's something kind of, I guess, that like this album was for me, and different objects have been over the years, and I'm sure have been for other people, where they become these weird totems that almost become bigger than whatever the thing is.
Sure.
In and of itself for you, where you just you sort of build a whole world around them, if that's all you have.
Right.
And I don't
know
if kids still do that, because maybe they have a lot more access to a lot more things at once, but
sure, a lot more stimulus
do.
For sure.
Maybe they do. I don't know.
Yeah. What was the earliest comedy stuff you listened to if you weren't watching a lot of TV?
I think that the Weird Al was a big one, just like he was for everyone.
Sure.
I have a line in this one man show that I do about like being excited to get into another band that's not the Bare Naked Ladies, because I could tell that they would be the perfect methadone to wean me off of Weird Al and into adult music.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so he was really big for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that my first music most of my first music experiences, if it wasn't like a musical,
yeah,
because I was in a family that was really into musicals, was something that was like comedy related. So it wasn't just music; it was like comedy music, or you know, like Weird Al, like explicitly like parodies and stuff like that, and his originals.
Right.
Not to take anything away from,
of course,
from Al.
Did you find yourself weaned off of Weird Al, or was that possible?
I think at one point for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the last Weird Al album I got was the one, whatever the one before Running with Scissors was.
Mm-hmm.
And then by that point, by the time I got to high school, it was like, oh, I don't really go in for Weird Al anymore. And now as a grown up, I've come to totally appreciate him and like him and give him his proper due. But at the time, it seemed very important to kind of distance yourself.
And I tried that too.
Sure.
I had a girlfriend who didn't like him. So that was my thing. I was like, okay, I can, no, but I couldn't fight it.
Right.
It was very hard to fight.
Yeah, no kidding.
Like, pussy didn't stop it, man. I'm sorry, I never get that vulgar on the show. I apologize.
Something
you can
about
swear.
Weird Al brings
it
out of you.
It really does. You can swear on the show.
Oh,
by the way.
You're
not
that.
Swearing enough is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay. I see.
So your parents exposed you to a lot of musicals. You said a lot of musical stuff. Were they a big influence on what you liked on the funny stuff that you liked, or your sense of humor?
I think so. I mean, I remember wanting to watch The Simpsons because people at school were really into it, and this is kind of when it was first coming out, and it was sort of culturally in the sort of eat my shorts vector, which it has since more than transcended, you know, for 20 years now or more. I remember not being allowed to watch The Simpsons because my mom was like, well, I mean, it says eat my shorts.
Right.
You know, in the parents' magazines I read, they say that you can't let your kid watch The Simpsons because then they'll start requesting that you eat their shorts.
Right.
And she was like, we can't watch The Simpsons. And then I remember my dad, they watched it like after we went to bed or something. He was like, we have to watch this.
That's awesome.
So the ban on The Simpsons was lifted because it was like clearly more than that, and it was clearly really funny.
Did you ever share did you ever share comedy with like friends, or make friends over comedy, or like sit and have moments where you listened or watched?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, my best friend in elementary school, who I met in like fourth grade, Trevor, was the kind of my gateway into the Weird Al world. I think he had like Weird Al tapes and CDs and stuff like that I then got really into. We were really into Monty Python and shit like that. I mean, sort of unsurprising things to be into if you're someone that was my age. Yeah, we were into like Monty Python and stuff like that.
Yeah. Did you, what was your, how early were you being creative, like writing? How early were you writing or performing, I guess? You mentioned it earlier a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I was a little bit. I mean, I was into, I don't know, I guess a halfway decent story is like there was some school assignment where we were supposed to make a like hand turkey, you know, and then like color it in and stuff like that. And I remember saying to my mom, like, oh, I want to do, I want to like make like a poem to like go along with it, like a Night Before Christmas parody, but with like Thanksgiving. She's like, oh, that's a good idea. You should do it. And then I was like, ah, maybe not. It's kind of like more work. And she was like, no, you should always do more work than is required. You shouldn't just do like just what's required. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. So she guilted me into it. So I did it. And then I ended up, the teacher liked it. And then she passed it along to the principal. And I got to read the poem on the school loudspeaker. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, I have gotten attention. It was very exciting.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I guess that was sort of the beginning of kind of like doing things that weren't explicitly, creative things that weren't explicitly required in school.
Sure.
And I was in like a shitty musical that my like music teacher in elementary school had written,
really?
Which was pretty exciting.
Oh
yeah,
my God.
It was in school. It was like a school project, but she had written it, and it was something about like, a scientist going to like the heart of the jungle to find like a magic root that could like cure all disease or something like
Holy
that.
Shit.
I know, yeah, that's pretty ambitious.
Pretty
huh?
That's pretty wonderful.
And there were two different casts because you had a lot of kids
mm-hmm.
that you needed to put in it.
Right. Did you are there any songs on re-listening to this that are much more poignant than they were? I mean, obviously they're all going to have a little more breadth to them. That for you, but
yeah, I think so. I mean, I should have pulled up the track list on my phone or something like that.
Whoa.
Here, I can do that now. Don't worry about it. Yeah, I mean, I think that most of the ones that were more poignant upon re-listening were ones that I would have just outright skipped
mm-hmm.
when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about it when I was listening to it, and like there were always those songs that you would skip because you'd be like, oh, that's for, you know, like I said, slow or for girls or both.
Right, right.
In your mind at the time. Oh, they did the theme to Big Bang Theory. I didn't realize.
Yes, they did.
Wow. That... you would sometimes find yourself, and I feel like this was true all the way into middle school, into high school, even now as a grown-up, where you're like, oh, I don't listen to that song, I always skip it, and then for some reason you kind of like let it play,
mm-hmm.
and then you actually are like, oh, wait, this is good. And then you are like, oh, okay, maybe I'll listen to it again, you know, at some point, and then you never do.
Yeah.
But in that one moment that you let it play through, you're like, oh, wow, I get it, this is totally... I get why people that like slow songs and girls like
right.
this.
I never thought there'd be days like this. There was always someone at my door. I never thought I would ever miss. The crowd would always holler for more. But now it seems all that people want is what I used to be. Every time I try to do something new, all they want is 1973. I never thought I'd be regretful of all my past success. But some stupid number one hit singer has got me in this mess. You can put it on every compilation, that's alright. You can hear it on the oldies radio station every night.
I suppose that's the power more to music that's got a comedic... I would imagine it's harder to re-listen to an old stand-up album or an old anything album and maybe find it resonating in the same way because it's maybe a little harder to search for the layers. I could be
right.
wrong.
Yeah, know? No, I think you're right. I mean, I think unless it's something that you were listening to when you were super duper young.
Yeah.
And then now... Or maybe, like, if you were listening to something, that, like, let's say an album that was all about parenting, and then you go back and you listen to it when you're a parent, it probably has a totally different resonance for you than when you were a kid, and it was just like, well, it's just funny, and then something in it actually happens to you, and then you listen to it again, you're like, oh, now it kind of has meaning to it. But I don't think you're going to get as much of just like with this album where I'm like, oh, I just didn't even know what half the words even meant, and now I do, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes perfect sense.
I mean, one, it was interesting, like a song, there were a couple of the songs on the album that I would always listen to as a kid, and you want it to be a joke, or you want it to be funnier than it is, because you like the song, so you're looking for what you think you're looking for from this album, which is like it being funny, right? And so a song like Lying in, or a song like Brian Wilson, which is the, you know, the immortal line, you know, lying in bed just like Brian Wilson did.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't even really know who Brian Wilson was. That kind of had to be, like, explained to me. And the first, my introduction to the idea of Brian Wilson as Recluse was via this album, and via having to, like, ask my dad, like, what does that mean? I don't get it. And him sort of explaining a little bit. And it's like, you, at the time, you're like, oh, it must be funny, right?
Sure.
And it's got this reference in it, so that's maybe trying to be funny. But when you listen to it now, it's like, oh, it's not a funny song at all. It's a great song.
Of course.
It's very resonant, but it's not necessarily, like, trying to be, you know, hilarious.
I suppose the pain of an artist is harder for an 8-year-old to grasp.
Sure.
Maybe a little bit. That's actually interesting, too, because we've talked on this podcast quite a bit about sometimes the way you discover comedy or discover what's funny is by your surroundings, or by maybe watching something with your parents. They'll laugh, you won't get the joke, but you know that was supposed, that's a cue.
Right.
That's a social cue for you to learn comedy. But you went out of your way to actually have somebody explain it to you. You weren't embarrassed enough to have somebody explain what you didn't understand, which I find admirable for a young,
You
know, I couldn't do that as a kid. I don't know how you did, but did you do that with all kinds of comedy?
I think so, yeah. I mean, or you mean just, like, not getting, like, certain references to things?
Like, if you didn't get it, were you going out of your way to understand it immediately, or were you ever desperate to just feel like you understood it?
A little bit of both, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I realized, like, a year ago, I was like, oh, I think my favorite, like, references in things are ones that I don't get.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? I'm a big fan of The Best Show. Tom Sharpling's The Best Show, and, like, Sharpling and Worcester, and I don't know how familiar you are with them, but they have, both of those guys have such an encyclopedic knowledge of rock history,
right?
And when you're listening to them do, like, a character piece or a call or whatever, there's so much that they do that is references things that you have no idea what they are. That's like the lineup of some, like, punk band in 1974.
Yeah.
And you're so not familiar with it, but something about the specificity of it makes it funny, even though you don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Like, I always think of, like, my first exposure to Christopher Walken was in a joke in Animaniacs, where they go to a party and they're the first ones there, but they're like, oh, you're not the first ones here. Christopher Walken's been here for an hour. And then it cuts to him in the corner and he's like, hello. And looking back on it, it was like a very accurate caricature of Christopher Walken, his voice and everything like that. And I've come to learn, apparently, apocryphally, in, like, showbiz lore, he does actually show up to parties like an hour early.
That's so funny.
And is the first person there. And so that was, like, playing off that, which no kid could ever know. And, like, you had no idea who Christopher Walken was. And I mean, I think that even goes back to, like, Looney Tunes, where it would always feature, like, some random dude that was popular in the 30s, and you have to imagine, like, oh, the kids watching it then must have understood who that was, but probably not, actually.
Yeah.
It's just funny because it's just, like, a random guy with a weird face going, like, bah, 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 bah.
Right.
And you're just like, that's funny, because then something falls on him or whatever.
Right.
And so something about, even if you don't get the reference, something about the specificity of it is already funny to you.
I think
I feel like if you're a remotely curious person, I think that there's an alternate way of thinking whereby, oh, I don't understand that. That's clearly a reference. I don't get it. Therefore, boo.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But to me, you know, some of the best things are things that you don't get. I mean, that's why the music of, say, somebody like a Ghostface Killah is you know, so enticing is because it's full of just like weird slang and references that you're like, oh, maybe a lot of people get this, but then more and more you think about it, you're like, maybe nobody gets this. Maybe this is so hyper-specific.
Right.
Like, there was a great, there's a line in a Ghostface Killah song where he says, spiced out Calvin Coolidge, which I went on rapgenius.com to be like, does anyone know what this, and I looked all over on the internet. No one has any idea what he means by spiced out Calvin Coolidge.
Oh my
but it
God.
Sounds awesome.
Of
it sounds like the coolest thing ever. And you have no idea what it means. And so that's, I kind of, there's something really, I don't like it when things are explicitly references or you have to get a certain reference to understand the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I feel like that's the mark of truly great parody is you don't have to be familiar with the underlying thing for it to function in and of itself.
Right.
And I would say that's true of, you know, great stuff like really good episodes of Community where it's like they might be parodying something. But if you've never seen the thing that they're parodying, it doesn't matter.
Of course.
Hopefully. The Simpsons, same thing. Just like, you know, anything that that parodies stuff. But so this album was super interesting because I guess you have like the Brian Wilson thing, or you have a song like Box Set, which is written from the perspective of an artist that's been around forever, that's like releasing a new box set, and he's taking you through it. And it's a sort of hall of mirrors of regret.
Yes.
Of how his career has sort of peaked, and now everyone's calling him a sellout for releasing this box set that's like, disc one is all the hits.
Right.
And then the disc two is blank because it was going to be new songs, but then some other label has the rights to them, so disc two is blank. And disc three is some demos, and it's great. It's tremendous. But it's interesting thinking back on it, and it was almost like an introduction to being a music fan.
Mm-hmm.
Because part of being a music fan is having kind of like snobbish opinions about things.
Sure.
And you can tell that these guys are huge music fans when you listen to this. I mean, like, they're obviously jazz dorks.
Yep.
Like, there's so much kind of like, you know, really great, impressive, technically impressive jazz shit going on here. But also, like, I was noticing as I was listening to the first track again today, Hello City, there's like a, at the end they just interpolate this House Martin song, Happy Hour, which I'd never heard until like 2 years ago, so I never would have caught that.
Yeah.
And then when I was listening to the song today, I was like, oh, that sounds kind of like that House Martin song. And then at the end, sure enough, they go into
That's
it
funny.
At the end and like lace it in, which was pretty cool, and I never would have noticed that.
Sure.
So I guess what I'm saying is sometimes references are cool. No, but it is also, I guess, like a... I don't know if it's a generational thing, but like growing up in, I guess I would have been like, you know, 8 years old in 1992 when this album came out, and probably 10 by the time I was actually listening to it. And so much of 90s popular culture was almost the, in my mind, this is probably wrong, there's probably many examples of it beforehand, things like Clerks, Reservoir Dogs, and pop culture that was kind of looking back on itself, that was made by dudes that were really into references, were really into like film nerd culture, music nerd culture, and stuff like that. And it was culture that acknowledged that other culture was out there.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there was lots of that for many, many years, but I feel like it really came of age in the 90s.
That
particular sort of hyper-referentiality. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, you know, dating back to Shakespeare,
of course,
works of art reference other works of art all the time, but there's just something about it that seems so incredibly 90s,
right?
And I feel like this is a real 90s album, so it was interesting to kind of come in and your like primary texts of a thing that you get into are referencing other things themselves, as opposed to just being a thing.
Yeah.
In and of itself.
Right.
Without any references.
I think a lot of people that's one of the reasons people treat the 90s as so bleak culturally. I would disagree. Even though it felt that, some of it definitely felt that way. You know, not to be a hipster about it, but a lot of the mainstream shit did feel much bleaker. But I can see exactly what you're saying, it was a new era of art. Where it was a collage without necessarily pointing out the fact that it's a collage. You know?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I also think that there was, on the flip side of the bleakness, there's something about the way that reference in popular culture was conducted and popularized in the 90s mm-hmm. that was so loving.
Sure.
That I don't think is necessarily always the case now.
Three flights to the streetlights and the bar fights. We're just taking in the sights. I hope tomorrow that I wake up in my own bed. Hello, city.
Like, I think a lot of times when pop culture now references other pop culture, it's not doing it out of a sense of love, it's doing it out of a sense of, well, if I just combine these two things that already exist,
yeah.
people will pay attention to my thing,
mm-hmm.
because I don't have to acquaint them with a new thing. If I can just go, this is literally that!
Right.
Remember that?
Yeah.
It's like, what if the guy from Saved by the Bell was in space? You know Saved by the Bell, you know what space is, you're sold.
Right.
As opposed to having to be like, this is this whole new thing
it's the
that
same
I have
thing
to sell you on.
Kind of destroyed, well, not destroyed, but really hurt parody, which is
sure.
know, a lot of shitty parody movies doing exactly what you're talking about.
Sure.
Not knowing how
exactly.
to do it. Not knowing
exactly.
how to integrate it.
There was a, it was funny, my girlfriend and I were watching an episode from season 2 of RuPaul's Drag Race last
uh-huh.
night, as you do.
Sure.
And it contained, and I'm not sure this is entirely on topic, but it feels appropriate, and this is just the first venue that I've had to be able to talk about it. They, one of the, I don't know if you've ever seen the show, but it's these drag queens competing to see who's going to be like, you know, win a bunch
yeah.
of different cool sponsorship deals and stuff like that. And one of the challenge this week was they were basically playing match game, but all the different drag queens had to dress up as different celebrities and like play them
God.
During this game of match game. And all of the judges end up having this really great discussion about what constitutes parody, essentially.
Really?
Because there are certain people on the certain contestants that, like, there's one girl that's like, I'm going to be Pink. I'm going to dress up as Pink. And
yeah.
That's great. And RuPaul's kind of being like, I mean, well, what's funny to you about Pink? And she's just like, oh, I just think she, you know, she doesn't take any shit and she's great. And RuPaul's just kind of like, huh, and just like moves on.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, clearly, what he's thinking is like, well, it's one thing to think, oh man, she's really cool, she doesn't take any shit.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't constitute fertile ground for comedy necessarily.
Right, right.
Whereas then the girl that plays Britney Spears totally kills it.
Sure.
Because you can tell she might not be a huge Britney Spears fan per se.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she is,
mm-hmm.
but she also has a certain amount of distance from Britney Spears
yeah.
where she can like critique her and play her as a character
right.
and play off what our cultural associations are with Britney Spears. Whereas the girl that's playing Pink is just up there being like, I really look like Pink.
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah.
they come around to her and she's like, oh man, y'all know how I do. Anyway, here we go. You know, like there's just nothing there. And it was like, oh man, if RuPaul's Drag Race contains the best sort of little intricate discussion I've seen about the
yeah.
distance between subject and reference
yeah.
that I've ever seen in like real popular culture, that's
yeah.
I guess great for RuPaul.
That is great for RuPaul, but holy shit.
But you're right, because nobody knows how to do parody.
No.
No,
no, just Weird Al. Weird Al's the only guy's consistent.
30
fucking years.
Yeah.
30 years.
Yeah, because people just think, and I mean, I also say this as somebody that writes for a ton of award shows,
mm-hmm.
where you're called upon to, I guess, ostensibly spoof the
sure.
things that have happened in a year or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
People really think that all it is like, then we just put that guy in the hat that the guy wore in the movie, and then he comes out.
Yep.
And it's like, no, it's not just the hat. It's got to be more than, there's got to be something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not mm-hmm. enough to just have Bane come out. It's like you got to have then Bane reads his shopping list
yes,
or whatever. You
right.
know what I mean? Like
yes,
that's
yeah.
all you need. It's
yeah.
not. It's not rocket science,
yeah.
but it is science.
Mm-hmm. Comedy's putting a thing on its head, and I don't understand how people have lost sight of
right.
that.
They,
it's a matter, I guess, of just needing to make a thing and forgetting that needing to make a thing distances you from not just quality, but from having a perspective on it. I suppose.
Yeah. You know? Totally. Totally. Well, it's like. You're right. Comedy is turning a thing on its head.
Sure.
And it's hard to turn a thing on its head, mm-hmm. right? That's effort.
Yeah.
Why not just be able to have the thing?
Right. Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, oh, well, if we have to come up with a perspective, then people have to be on board with knowing what the thing is and the perspective.
Right.
What if all that was required of you was knowing what the thing was? Great? Great. Very easy. Well, it's not funny. Well, who cares?
Right.
We've already sold a lot of Taco Bell just based off of this conversation. If that makes any sense. So and there's I think there's something too to bring it back to Gordon about the reference culture of the 90s that was very, and I'm saying this as kind of an outsider to it because I was, you know, a kid.
Sure.
But just my third hand perception of it. It was loving because it was handmade to a certain degree.
Yeah.
There was no ability to, or very limited ability to, by the end of the decade, to just link to a picture of something.
Right.
You had to actually be familiar with it.
Sure.
And you only have so much space in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one thing to be able to just send somebody a link to an entire scene from a movie, and it's another thing to actually have that entire scene from that movie in your head, which you might have in your head because it never came out on video, or it came out on video and you lost the video, and there's nowhere else that you can get it, or you gave it to your friend Gary and then he moved or died and didn't leave you the video in his will. And so there was something that was very almost like a weird oral tradition element to it, if that makes any sense.
And that I makes think perfect sense.
You cite things like Clerks and Reservoir Dogs and stuff like that as examples of the oral, sort of an oral tradition of culture.
Yeah. And I guess that's interesting because that is sort of it's the beginning of a new era of pop culture, you know, that you're talking about of this self-referential and this referential culture, but it's also the end of the ability for it to still be relevant, I suppose, in a way, because like you said, it's hard. You don't have to work for it anymore.
For sure.
Know? So that doesn't make sense.
And there's also just much more stuff to reference, if that makes any sense.
Yep.
And as has been pointed out by smarter people than me in other venues, you know, culture has become just infinitely more stratified. And so, you know, you might go on some forum online where somebody will be like, blah, or post some GIF or something, and you're like, I don't, and they're like, that's a reference to a video by a guy that was referencing My Little Pony, and why don't you get that?
Right.
And, it's sort of, now you have, like, memes and shit, which are very entertaining sometimes, especially if you understand them, and there are a sort of interesting progression of culture in and of themselves, but each one of them is its own weird little reference on a reference on a reference on a reference, and it's tougher to keep track of all that. Simultaneously tougher and easier because you can also just Google it, and then there's a thing that's like, here's what this meme is.
And it then becomes less emotional. There's less of an investment.
Absolutely.
You're talking about the idea of we're still talking about it, but of not getting a reference necessarily, but reacting to it, and shit.
What's that?
I had a question.
Yes.
And then it just fucking escaped my brain.
Okay.
This happens once an episode.
Okay.
And I bring it up once an episode that it's going to happen. and it's happened.
Uh-huh.
I had something. Let's move on to some other point.
Sure.
About son of a whore. Let's talk about another track you like, and then if my brain goes back on track, then we'll get there. Because I'm more familiar listening to this. I'm like, oh yeah, I know Brian Wilson. I know Be My Yoko Ono. I know If I Had $1 Million.
Right.
And they're not necessarily the deepest on the album either. They're the ones that everybody knew and loved.
Yes and no.
I mean, Brian Wilson, you're right.
Right.
Is more than I realized, but...
Well, I found weirdly, like, Box Set and If I Had $1 Million to be super poignant, given the fact that I know that the band has since, as you put it, effectively broken up.
Right. Right.
Or, I mean, at least their original lineup, because, like he says in Box Set, now some... stupid number one hit single has got me in this mess.
Yeah.
Which is like, well, they did.
Right.
Have I won, if not more. I mean, 1 week definitely was.
For sure.
Hit singles, and now I'm sure are probably dealing with the problems of legacy that their rock nerdiness, if anything, probably over-prepared them to think about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, you know, I don't know that being a nerd in and around a thing before you know, like, people always talk about Prince being a music nerd and being really into, like, reading reviews and stuff like that, even of his own stuff. And therefore very obsessed with like his legacy and everything like that. Like, I don't know if that necessarily better prepares you to deal with those problems,
right?
Because and I'm sure this is true of tons of comedians too. I think they think, and we talk about as comedians, like, oh yeah, man, I mean, if I ever get to be where that guy is, I'm going to do this and this and this differently. And then you might get there and find out, oh, there's a reason why those people do X, Y, and Z things.
Right.
And it's not always necessarily as simple as, oh, they just suddenly decided not to care anymore.
Right.
And then sometimes maybe they did actually just decide not to care anymore,
sure.
For sure. But yeah, so I found, and then songs like If I Had $1 Million, where it's like, oh, I'm sure that guy felt weird the first time he saw a check that was actually for $1 million.
Right.
There was something, because there's so... there's so much on the album that seems to be written from the perspective of a bunch of goofballs who don't feel like they're ever probably going to be super famous. They're just like, this is fun. This stuff makes us laugh.
Yeah.
When we play these songs, especially that have these references in them and these musical interpolations at bars and in gigs and stuff, people really like it. And they can be like, oh, right, you're the guys with the fucking Yoko Ono song, lovingly criticizing rock stardom,
right,
and then ultimately becoming rock stars.
Drove downtown in the rain, 9:30 on a Tuesday night, just to check out the late night record shop. Call it impulsive, call it compulsive, call it insane, but when I'm surrounded I just can't stop. It's a matter of instinct, it's a matter of conditioning, a matter of fact. You can call me Pavlov's dog. Ring a bell and I'll salivate. How'd you like that? Dr. Landy, tell me you're not just a pedagogue. Cause right now I'm lying in bed, just like Brian Wilson did. Well, I'm lying in bed, just like Brian Wilson did.
I mean, I definitely remember watching like Total Request Live in high school, which I did every day after school despite not liking any of the music on it. Or at the time, in my mind, being like, I don't like any of this music. And now, when I listen back to any of that stuff, I'm like, I like it a lot.
Yeah.
You know, like Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and stuff like that. But like... I mean, I was into The Offspring, man. They kept it real.
Yeah.
TRL.
Yeah.
When there was a Bare Naked Ladies song that was like, oh, this is this new song, and it's the Bare Naked Ladies, and they're from Canada, whatever. I remember feeling a real sense of like, oh, good for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is weird to say, because I was like, you know, 13, 14 years old at that time.
Right.
You know, sort of probably like 4 years after my Gordon listening phase, 4 or 5 years afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But, really feeling like, oh, I knew him back when, which was also a fun, interesting first cultural opportunity to be like, oh, it's pretty ahead of the curve on this one.
Right.
No big deal. I'm kind of over it by this point. you know, it was, which would then sort of set a pattern for the rest of my life as a snob. but yeah, so, I mean, I have to imagine that they were. Or maybe they weren't. I don't know. Maybe they were always like, yeah, we're eventually going to crack America and have a really big record and stuff like that. Maybe they were explicitly trying to do that. I mean, I think that when you listen to 1 week, it's really almost a pretty great encapsulation of all of the stuff that they're doing on this album, i.e. Sort of speedy arch cultural references combined with actual sort of romantic... pathos a little bit. I mean, it's certainly on the relatively light end of the romantic pathos spectrum for them, but it's in there for sure. And so it's kind of like, oh man, they really, and it's a super catchy, well-made song.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess good for them.
Sure.
I mean, it wasn't like Sugar Ray, where it's like, oh, we're a heavy metal album, or we're a heavy metal album, we're a heavy metal act. Mm-hmm. We have one goof around song at the end of our record. Then that's the one that becomes a hit. And then we're just like, I guess we're that now. Like, I don't think the Bare Naked Ladies, to their huge credit, ever had to be like, oh, I guess we have to go be like our hit single now. Because I think that hit single is pretty much an you can draw a pretty short line between Gordon and that song.
Yeah.
Although I didn't ever get that album, and I haven't gotten any of their albums since this one.
Sure. That's actually a pretty strong point about it is kind of a pure the go, fucking Christ. Crap, man! You just
You're
said
right,
so much.
Jason.
No, I'm having a stroke. If that's okay, it's a mini stroke.
Adorable.
Thank you so much. God, there's so much to talk about. No, that's what I was going to ask you about. Okay, so you are a writer. You are a sketch comedian.
Yes.
When you look back at your own early stuff, like a lot of early YouTube stuff, mm-hmm. Do you find anything, because you know you guys are finding more and more success as the days go by, do you find any of your early stuff resonating at all as far as anything similar to how these guys were in the early parts of their career? Anything that's a little more irreverent towards where you're going to be?
Oh,
sketch wise it's hard because it's not as easy.
I mean, can you expand upon
that? Sure, no, because you're saying that this album does not feel like they were necessarily concerned with, like you said, cracking
right.
America and who they
right,
were going
right,
to be.
Right.
Sketch comedy has to be, by its nature, so very self-aware. I'm
right.
just wondering, is there anything where you can look back and it was so fresh and so reflective of you not giving a fuck?
I think so. I mean, I think also, well, it's interesting. I feel like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if we ever had anything where it's like, oh, we would never do that now.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we wouldn't do it now because we're on essentially a permanent hiatus.
Right.
But I don't think there was anything that we were doing that it's like, oh, if we had been randomly given a primetime television show,
yeah.
we would have been like,
excuse me.
We would have been like, we're not doing that. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I think that there was pretty much all this stuff, because I'm a firm believer in, you know, do the thing that you would do for money for free. Do exactly mm-hmm. that thing. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, because I feel like a lot of people have in their heads like, okay, well, I mean, when the cameras are actually there
mm-hmm.
and I'm actually on set of my $50 million movie,
yeah.
you'll see, I'll really give a shit. I mean, right now it's not that, obviously, so why would I care?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people who can't wait for someone else to come and give them money to like unlock their no doubt vast potential
right. Right.
rather than actually demonstrating that potential every time they do anything,
mm-hmm.
no matter what the size is, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that for the most part there it was all stuff that with very few exceptions that we would, you know, would have done no matter what the scale.
Yeah.
I think you just do the best thing that you can do with what you have available,
for
ideally.
Sure.
And there was also nothing that I can think of off the top of my head where it was like then critiquing our later selves, although you definitely get that a lot in
yeah.
art where you have... but I think that's also a natural... something that's going to naturally happen because when you're, you know, a younger, I think, person, you tend to have a sort of a less nuanced contempt for everything.
Yep.
Where you're just like, oh, those guys are stupid. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't do that. And then as you go along and as you progress in your career, you do look out the window of the car you're on, of the highway of life, and see all of the compromises that people make go by.
Sure.
And see, like, oh, okay, I now actually, if not... if I wouldn't do those things myself necessarily still, you do see why people do them. I think you're more
yeah.
empathetic to them. But I do think that this album has, that Gordon has a great deal of empathetic songwriting on it. Like, I feel like the box set, the protagonist of that song that they're writing from his perspective, even though it's satirical and they're making fun of that, I do think that there is a lot of empathy for that guy
mm-hmm.
feeling trapped by his own success. And I think that there is, you know, a lot of empathy even in the New Kid on the Block song
mm-hmm.
where this guy also, again, feels trapped by his people perceiving him as a new kid on the block, but then also being like, fuck you, man. I'm a dick.
Right.
You don't know me.
Right.
Which is pretty great.
There's a lot of music about making music on here now that I'm
for sure.
thinking about it.
For sure.
Comedy about making comedy, I suppose, is it harder, do you think? Is it harder for you?
Oh, man. I mean, I don't know. It depends. I think comedy about making good comedy, I don't know if I'd be too interested
right,
in that.
Right,
you know what I mean? Like, you look at something like, well, I mean, it's the difference between Studio 60 and 30 Rock.
Yes.
Where
yes.
Studio 60 purported to, and all due respect to Sorkin, who I really like.
Sure.
And I'm also not the first person to make this observation about Studio 60 versus 30 Rock. But Studio 60, there, it's a drama which attempted to have comedic elements in it about making what is, in the world of the show, actually really groundbreaking, amazing comedy,
right?
That's gonna like change the world and mm-hmm. be hilarious, but also like make people think. Mm-hmm. It is this sort of weird myth mm-hmm. of comedy as opposed to what it actually is.
Yep.
Whereas it's great because 30 Rock, which is made by, you know, one of the funniest people of the past, you know, 25 years, is about people making a really shitty sketch show
yeah.
that you don't get that much of, but in the little glimpses you do get of it, a la like Fart Machine, which they cut back to throughout the series, is terrible and
yeah.
silly and ephemeral. And I think that most truly funny people don't view what they do as like, this is the most important thing ever.
Right.
They view it as like, hey, closer to, oh, this is some dick and fart jokes.
Yes.
And let other people find the importance in it.
Sure.
If that makes any sense.
That can be the hard part with satire, I suppose, because you're walking a dangerous, dangerous line there that is self-importance and losing that
totally.
Self-importance to be...
Totally.
Mean, did you have a part that you can remember distinctly as an early comedy writer feeling that and then having to lose it, or is it just gradual?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you kind of, especially in sketch, you'll occasionally have a moment, and I had a few of these early, really early on, like I feel like freshman year of college, being in a sketch group where your sketch is like humming along, it's got a funny idea, it's well executed, and then there will occasionally be a line or two that is too much, the author being like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? You
yeah.
still feel that mm-hmm. anytime you see sketch, especially, you know, people that are early on in doing sketch, where it's more about how superior am I to these characters mm-hmm. than it is you know, just playing out an idea. And mm-hmm. I do think you see that a lot.
If I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a house,
I would buy you a house.
And if I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
buy you furniture for your house,
maybe a nice Chesterfield or an ottoman.
And if I had $1 million,
if I had $1 million,
well, I'd buy you a K-car,
a nice Reliant automobile.
And if I had $1 million, I'd buy your love.
Go up there and hang out.
Like, open the fridge and stuff.
I feel like for some reason, you see it quite often when people that are more actors than they are comedians mm-hmm. attempt sketch. You okay. see a lot of like, here's this dumb girl. She's not like me. She's dumb. And it's like, that's... That doesn't really have a whole lot to say. Maybe it does, I guess. Maybe she is dumb.
Maybe.
Does that make sense, though?
No, it does. It makes perfect sense. I will point out also that I have, since we started this podcast, wanted to see a rabbit dancing to this
right?
whole album.
Yeah.
And had YouTube... I hate this hypothetical, but had YouTube existed at the time, you could have instantly put that together.
Right, exactly. You know? It would have been immortalized.
And then you would have wanted to kill yourself after everybody called you a fag.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, which would not be
and
your
then people
fault.
On Reddit would have attempted to buy me an iPod and be like, it's not good enough. This doesn't fix it.
let's talk about so that we don't forget. Let's plug
sure.
some of your stuff, because
please.
You have a book.
I do.
I have several
yes.
books, but
yes, the most recent book is called Crap Kingdom. It is relatively fresh off the shelf, fresh out of the... It just came out pretty recently. And it is a young adult book. It's a comedic fantasy adventure about a kid who loves Harry Potter and Chronicles of Narnia and stuff, and basically anything where a normal kid from our world is plucked out of obscurity and taken to a fantasy realm where he finds out that he's the chosen one. and that actually happens to our main character. Mm-hmm. He is plucked out of our normal world and taken to a fantasy realm where he finds out that he is the Chosen One, but unfortunately the fantasy realm in which he's the Chosen One, as it turns out, is really, really shitty. And so it's like a comedic fantasy adventure. It is ostensibly young adult, but I think people of all ages will enjoy it, and people have seemed to enjoyed. People have seemed to have been enjoying it. Well, that's a real... I don't write like that in the book, I swear to God. I don't write like I just talked. My first book is called The Boy Who Couldn't Sleep and Never Had To, which is also out there and available. They're in bookstores, they're on Amazon, they're on Kindles, they're on iPads. They're just about any way you can get books. They're out there, so check them out.
I forgot to ask you, if you're going to recommend to people why to listen to this album if they haven't heard it before.
The songs are really good. I think that was one thing that we sort of left behind. Like the just sort of basic song craft is really great. It's alternately kind of catchy and effervescent, and then trending into kind of darker, but it never gets like, you know, it's not sludgy. Yeah. It's all kind of light and like, I hesitate to use the term jazzy because I don't think anyone thinks of that as being a positive thing, even though it sometimes can be, actually. But yeah, and there's a lot of really beautiful songs on there. And I think also, too, something that I was realizing when I was listening back to it is that the funny stuff and the dark stuff just sort of coexist without a whole lot of apology or acknowledgement that those two things are coexisting. And I think that's great. I love that. I mean, that's my favorite thing. It's something that I sort of strive for in my own stuff is having things that can be really funny and then can be hopefully poignant or moving or have some sort of emotional resonance beyond just like fart. Even though, you know, that's pretty moving
it's
in its
great.
Own way.
Yeah.
And so this album really has that and captures that. And I wish I were more conversant in the whole Bare Naked Ladies catalog so I could really put it in context. But it's good. It's funny stuff.
Well, the whole point is put it into context as to what it, you know, among the other things that influence you.
Right.
Do you feel a specific influence on your comedy from this album, or is it just generally how it influences the way you think about things?
I think I more feel an influence on my personhood because I felt like what this album and what a couple of different albums, a lot of grown-up music that I liked when I was a kid, did was sort of implant in you like an imaginary adulthood or an imaginary teenagehood, an imaginary 20-something hood. And now that I'm at the end of my 20s, it's like, was it anything like what I imagined it would be like? Well, no, but I also wasn't in Canada like they are on the record. But there's something really awesome about that really gives you the capacity for more empathy, because you just are sort of end up imagining these alternate lives for yourself. And while you're doing that, although you may never occupy them, you are imagining the lives of other people, be they real or imagined.
Yeah.
And that hopefully allows you, A, to make better stuff because you can more easily put yourself in people's shoes, and so you're not just writing that thing that's like, I'm stupid. I'm a stupid girl that the author of this thing knows. That's stupid. You're actually hopefully bringing some nuance to that and some depth. And then also, I think it just makes you hopefully be a better person because you can more easily imagine what someone else's life is like and what their struggles are. So I think that this album absolutely did program a lot of stuff like that in me, or started me down that path. So that's pretty cool. So I got to give the ladies credit where credit is due.
Of course. Let's make sure we plug everything else then.
Sure.
Twitter, Tumblr.
Twitter. I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/DC Pearson. I'm a good follow. I'm relatively prolific.
Agreed.
DCPearson.tumblr.com is where I write longer stuff sometimes and show plugs and stuff like that. So follow me over there. I do a weekly stand-up show here in Los Angeles called Big Money, which I co-host with Eliza Skinner. Mm-hmm. That's really fun. That's at the Virgil every Thursday, 7 p.m., 21 and over. It's free. They have good drink specials. And then I think that's the limits of the plugs. Yeah, people should definitely check out the books, though. I would really appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Sweet.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me, Jason. It was really fun. It's
been a lot of fun.
Thank you to the estranged Stephen Page and to the Bare Naked Ladies.
You know,
to
maybe if you come back on the show, we'll get them, and maybe you can help them patch things up.
Sounds great.
All right. Thank you guys for listening, and as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Visit StolenDress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, rate us highly, and write your reviews. You can follow us on Facebook.com/ComedyOnVinyl and Twitter @ComedyOnVinyl.
You can be my Yoko Ono. You can follow me wherever I go. Be my Yoko Ono. Oh, isn't it beautiful to see two people so much in love?